opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Kathy Kuhn. Ms. Kuhn, you may begin.
Thank you, Christina. Welcome, everyone, to this Westshore Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is Web Container Part 2, Troubleshooting Common Issues and Trace Analysis. The presenters today are Ashish Gadasera, Fu Din, Gabriel Marquez, Tan Jian. Ashish works in Webster Application Server Technical Support Organization for 11 years. He is team lead, technical lead, and subject matter expert of many components of WebSphere application server products. In his capacity, he works very closely with many customers and resolves complex critical issues and enables them to succeed using IBM solutions. He also contributes towards improving product quality, technical skill improvement, reducing hours per problem, and serviceability and usability improvements. Boo has been working on the WebSphere Container Component Level 3 support since 2007. In his role, he helps customers resolve application issues during the server migration. Gabriel joined IBM in 2007, working with the System Verification Test Team for the WebSphere Application Server 6.1 EJB Feature Pack release. In 2011, he was able to apply and extend his experience with WebSphere testing by joining the WebSphere Level 2 support community. In his current role of Client Technical Resolution Specialist, he serves as technical software support to clients globally, specializing in WebSphere web application configuration and problem resolution. Tom has been working in WebSphere Application Server Level 2 support for 8 years. She supports many WebSphere runtime components such as Web Container, JSP, JSF, Class Loader, Web Server. She specializes in WebSphere Class Loader and Web Container. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Ashish.
Thank you, Kathy. Let's go ahead and get started with slide number 2. Okay, so what we are going to cover is, and as Kathy mentioned, this is a part 2. So if you have missed part 1 of that we presented on last Tuesday, is we tried to cover the basics. We talked about serverless specifications. We talked about the application structure, application web application basics. And we also talked about the configuration aspect of a web container within a WebSphere application server. We also talked about in that presentation the very common custom properties and attributes that are being used by our customers, and in various scenarios those attributes and custom properties are useful. So to extend that, today we are going to quickly touch on Web Container Overview, maybe a little bit about application basics. But then we'll quickly dive into the core of this presentation of discussing a common errors that has, that we have been seeing in the Web Container area in WebSphere application server support teams. After discussing those common errors, we are going to take one by one and try to explain the high-level symptom analysis, how to resolve those common issues. And then at the end, we're going to dig more into the understanding the web container tracing and also recognizing some of the important points in trace analysis by Fu. He's doing that from many years in the level 3 team of web container. So we'll hear that straight from the experts. So with that, let's go to the slide number 3. All right, so very quickly, overview of Web Container. It is a runtime environment. When we say Web Container, it is a runtime environment for web applications. Its main job is to process dynamic content. And dynamic content for us is the servlet, JSP files, and other server side includes. The second thing Web Container does is it provides the full support of session management. Basically, the entire implementation of HTTP servlet specification along with some of the WebSphere or IBM extensions. It also processes the static content, act as an embedded web server, like the normal web server. The job is to serve the static content, like HTMLs, images, and other static files. It also contains the HTTP transport. So it sits on the top of the channel framework. So when the request comes in to the server, the first component of Web Container getting used is the Web Container channels. We'll go into the little bit more detail. And it reads the request and make it ready for Web Container component to process that request. In the last bullet, I wanted to emphasize that there is a one instance of Web Container per server. So if there is a server one or server instance, JVM instance is running, it's a one instance. All the application running on that server instance are going to be using one instance of Web Container. What that means, anything that you set as a Web Container custom properties getting that effect for all the things that is running, all the application that is running. Let's get to the slide number 4. Okay, so in the slide number 4, a little bit more granular details about the major component of Web Container. So if I have to break down the Web Container, I can break this down in 5 different sections. First portion is the Web Container transport chain, as I mentioned. It interacts very closely with the channel framework, and I did able to put the stack in order to show it a little bit better. So first 3 stack members are the channel framework, TCP layer, SSL layer, HTTP channel layer. And if you have not attended, last year we presented part 1 and part 2 for the channel framework. It's out there with the recording on the WSDE. But we did cover all the details about what is involved in TCP layer, SSL layer, and HTTP layer. Now, on the top of channel framework, which is the main job of channel framework, is to read the request from the wire and make it and pass it to the to the upper high level. Web Container channel is reads the request from HTTP channel layer, and it is associated with the request object and response object, makes some initialization some header, and then pass it for the processing. So that's the first component. The second part is the core, which is the servlet processing engine. All its job is to create a request object and response object, invoke the servlet service method, whatever the application it has been requested via URL. Servlet processing engine will execute that particular application service method, commit the response, and send the response back to the browser. So that's the entire job done by the servlet processing engine part. When the application is stopped, at that time, the destroy method of that servlet is called, and all the cleanup will happen, like unloading the servlets, or JVM performs the GCM things. Second part is the JSP engine. JSP engine is internal part of the Web Container, which gets executed when the request is made for the JSP resource. JSP, as you know, is just one layer up the servlet, which is easy to write the dynamic content, which needs the translation. And the JSP engine, generally, it's the job is to take the JSP as the input, translate it in a Java code, a servlet-like Java code, and then compile it to generate the class file. Once it's ready, it turns it back to the servlet processing engine, and the things will be processed as same as the servlet. The fourth portion is the static file or static content processing engine. We call it as an embedded web server. Main job is HTML and other static file content processing. So your application can contain HTML files, and that HTML file is served by this particular component. If we talk about a little bit detail about that component, it's just comprised of, the file serving servlets, which wraps around the response of the static content and serve it back. But that's a little bit internal detail how it's being handled. The last portion is a session management. It is a full extension and full implementation of HTTP session interface, along with many other extensions like distributed sessions, memory-to-memory persistency, failover support, and things like that. Now, let's go to the slide number 5. So let's talk about the common errors that we have been seeing in the web container area and in our support team. So if we categorize those common errors, then we can come up with the 6 categories. The first category is the family of HTTP 404 error messages, which includes the 2 parts. We're going to go in detail of both of those. The second part is the 500 error messages. And as you know, as you are familiar with HTTP protocol, 500 can be anything, right? But mostly we get the 500 error messages, the PMRs, on illegal street exceptions. Sometimes there is no exception in the in the logs, and still the 500 is coming from, and that's most likely or most probably end up being that the customer code, its application code, is setting 500. And we help to figure it out from where exactly in the code this 500 is being set. We're going to talk about more details. We'll talk about some unexpected errors from the web container that also end up being a 500 error. The third category is incorrect information on the browser. So there is no error in the logs, but when you request responses being received at the browser, you might see some rendering issues. Things are not properly aligned. Maybe the characters are garbled characters, or sometimes some other user's information is being set, session crossover kind of issue. So we are going to touch on that category as well. And the fourth one, we get many sometimes on the redirect issues. We are going to touch on various situations where WebSphere application server is responsible for redirecting, as well as some situations where the plugin or any other front end like a load balancer is in place, and when the application server try to redirect, the location URL won't be able to generate properly. So we are going to touch on those. And the sixth category we are going to touch is on some other errors, like IO3 errors and some other common HTTP errors that we are getting. So with that summary of common errors, let's go to the slide number 6 and start tackling one by one. Okay, the first category, HTTP 404 errors. There are 2 possible reasons. First possible reason, very obvious. File not found exception. I don't find the resource that you are looking for. That's the main reason. The second reason can be underneath you might be getting web group virtual host not defined. What that means is I'm not even finding web container is not even able to map your request to any application. And that is the reason of 404. So we are going to look at both of those categories in a separate way. So let's go to the slide number 7. So let's talk about the first reason of 404, file not found exception. When we get this exception, we are sure that we found the request being sent by the URL from the browser as a URL. Web container is able to map that request to the particular application, So web container knows which application is supposed to have this particular JSP or image file or whatever being requested. But when the web container goes and try to look for those resources at that particular location, it's not finding. So that is the reason of file not found. So first of all, for any 404 situations, right, try to see if in most cases, in the production environment, we have a web server and plugin, right? So try to see who is responsible for setting 404. There are situations where plugin also sets the 404 because it's not able to map your request and the resource is not there in IHS side. So it's good to know from where the 404 is coming from. If it is from application server side and it is a file not found exception, then whatever the theory that I was mentioning, it does apply. So how we are going to debug that? Very simple. We need to understand the URL. Verify the resource is present. So URL, understanding the various components of URL is the first part. URL generally comprise of host name and the port combination. So first portion leads us or leads request to the particular machine of the server. And then context route gives us from, let's say in that particular server, five applications are running. All the application has different context route, right? That's how they get recognized outside for the outside customers, right? So context route specifies which application going to serve that request. So now we are going to get a little bit narrow. And then in that application, where is that resource? You can have the directory inside that URL, and then at the end, the resource. So in my example, the application that is handling this particular URL is my app. I have the images directory. In the root of the ear file, I should be, if there is a 404 for this particular URL, then I'm going into the installed apps directory, going into the images folders, and see if I have my pictures.jpg. Okay, so most probably you won't have it, and that's the reason of 404. But there are situations you might see that, oh, my resource is there. Everything seems okay. My, installed app has the mypicture.jsp. What's going wrong? So the most probable reason behind it is the web share process does not have permission to execute that file or read that file. How that can happen? Very possibly, if your web server is started with non-root user, and if it's using some other user which may not have permission for this particular file system. So that is the only reason of 404 can happen. So if you see the resources there, still we are getting a 404, then check the chmod for your resources for that directory. Check the permissions of the user that you started your web server process with, and make sure that both are in sync and the user has permissions to execute that particular file. Okay, let's move on to the slide number 8. Okay, now let's talk about the second category of 404, where the error says web group virtual host not defined. As I mentioned, at this time, the host and port, with the host and port information of URL, the request did received at to the server level. Now, from here on, web containers cannot able to map that request to any application running on that server. And we throw the web group virtual host defined, right? And how to debug this stuff. So there are, these are step-by-step instructions that we are going to go through. The first step, common, just make sure that server is running and started properly. This is the line that you may want to look into your system out logs, like server 1, open for e-business. Second, if your application is started properly. And you should see the lines like application started with the application name. In this case, I picked the default application. And then, again, verify this. Once this two-step is done, now let's check, verify the URL is correct or not. I used the similar example of, you know, different component of URL. The first thing I'm going to do is there are two ways of doing it, from the support perspective and from admin perspective. You can just easier to do it from the admin console. But from support perspective, we sometimes we get the collector, so I'm also mentioning which files need to be checked for this configuration. So in this fourth step, we are going to the enterprise application, and then on the application page, click on the virtual host. And this will give me the information of which virtual host my application is installed on. In this case, it's the default host. Let's move on to the slide number 9. Okay. Next step, I'm going to go to that particular virtual host. So in this case, I navigated to the virtual host panel and then clicked on the default host, and then I clicked on the host aliases. So I'm checking the host aliases for that particular virtual host on which my application is installed. And this is the address that I found. So if we continue with our example, I had my own host name, which is ashish.raleigh.ibm.com, and my port was 9080. So it is covered. So if you can see, in the host alias, I do have that particular host because I have star. That means everything. And the port is 9080. So my combination is covered in this host alias. Now, next step is to check the server on which application is installed. So again, go back to the enterprise application, click on your application, and then click on target specific application status. So that panel should tell you on which application server your application is installed. In this case, it's server 1. With this information, let's go to the slide number 10. With this information, we know which server to check for the port. So now we are going to the application servers and clicking on that particular application server on which the application is running, and then click on the web container transport channel, which is under the additional property of the servers. Now see if that particular port is listed as one of the inbound port. In this case, I do have it. I have star 9080, which is listening on web container inbound default, which is the transport chain that we were talking, you know, on the initial slide, which is, you know, once you click on that WC inbound default, you will see that all the layers, TCP, SSL, HTTP, and web container. So that's the chain that's going to be reading your request. So it's confirmed. So what we checked so far is the host and port combination in URL exists in the server, also exists as one of the alias entry for the virtual host. Let's move on to the slide number 11. Now that we confirm everything is fine so far, let's check the next level, which is the context root in the URL. The way to check it is going again into the application. Application name, I'm taking the default application's example here. Once you go there, you should have the hyperlink for deployment descriptor. And, you know, once you click it, you should see the application.xml file in this. Now, this is the recommended way of checking your context root, because we have been burned in past. If you directly go to the configuration files, sometimes we might be looking into the local files and not the master file, and the information is not accurate. When you are looking from directly from the admin console, you know this is the configuration is in effect. So, okay, so going back to this point, if you look at closely, the context root is defined for web application. Default application is slash. So slash is my context root for this. So I should have this, right, you know, just a slash. In my previous example, I had my test or something, my app, which is a different application. In this particular application just has a slash. Let's go to the slide number 12. Once that is done, the next step is to see the resource, if the resource is particularly defined. Like if you are calling for servlet in that URL, right? How to check if that servlet is correctly defined in the web.xml. So the way to do it quickly is you can go to the applications again, default application in this case. Then you go to the manage modules. Application may have many modules, right? So you need to know which module is the one we are requesting for. So once you click on that particular module, in this case it's just one web module, which is the default web application dot here. Once you click on that, again you will see the hyperlink for deployment descriptor. Once you click on that, it will display the web.xml file for that particular web module. And in there, you will see the list of servlets being mapped and filter codes being mapped. So if the URL has one of those servlets, that URL pattern of those servlets, how it is being called, should match with whatever defined here. Let's go to the slide number 13. If the resource is being requested is something other than the servlet or filters, right? Then you can directly check into the proper locations. And I mentioned this, the file directory structure, which is a typical place where this all the resources are located. So in my case, it's under the installed, Webster installed, there is a profiles folder. Under the profiles folder, we should have the profile name. Under the profile name, we should be able to go into the installed apps, then cell name, then year file name, then the web module name. And under that, that is my root of the web module, WAR file. And here, maybe I have a directory. And if there is a directory, then that directory name should be part of my URL. And I should able to go to the directory and see if my resource is there, like a JPG or some kind of static or JSP files or HTML files. Okay, so these are the common steps that you can take to verify if things are mapped properly to debug the web group virtual host not found. Once you verify everything and if things, make necessary changes, this particular error message should go away. Let's move on to the next slide, slide number 14. Okay, so now we are going to talk about the second category of error messages, 500 error messages. And there are many reasons, as you may know. 500 is an internal server error. That is by definition of HTTP protocol. So we are going to talk about the major ones that we always see into the level 2 organization. The first one is JSP processing error. We are not going to talk much in this presentation. It's when the JSPs are not properly translated or some errors happening from the JSP engine, then it may occur. There was a few years back I presented some other WHT on JSP, has some details around that. The second one we are going to talk about is illegal state exceptions, and then we are going to cover for customer code setting 500. And there are some null pointers and unexpected error messages we are going to talk. So let's go to the slide number 15, please. All right, illegal state exception, right? By name, it tells something what is happening in the is illegal or against the specification. So one of the things I wanted to cover because there are two flavors of illegal state exception. One is by session manager. Session manager also sets the illegal state exception. When the application code try to touch the invalid session object, and this is always by the application development errors, I would say. The way it happens is in application, in your servlet or JSP, at one point, the application logic decides that, okay, I don't need session anymore, and I call session.invalidate. And so session is marked to be invalidated at that moment. Now we haven't finished, but we continue our logic of execution of the application. And later point of time, we start to, we forget and we start to use the same session and say the session.set attribute, for example. And that particular application line, you will see the session manager will throw illegal state exception. So my plan was not to cover too much about that as it's a separate topic, but give you a little bit of hint about if you've seen this exception in terms of session manager, then what needs to be looked at. Now let's talk about this illegal state exception happens from web container. Sometimes it happens as the warning messages, and sometimes it happens as an error. So first example is more towards the warning, right? It says illegal state exception header already set. What it says to us is one or more headers has been committed to the customer, to the client, meaning from web container perspective, when we send something over, we are going to say, sending back to the client or something, who is requesting the particular resource. So once it is committed, we cannot set the header again. And this is we display it as a warning message. And because it doesn't really break any flow of the application, but if your application is really depending on header that you are trying to set for your response, then you might see the errors later. So that's why it is a warning. One of the examples is like you already set some headers, and then later, so that means commit happened, and then at the later point, if you try to set some cookie, application cookie, right? Or maybe you just created a session, HTTP session later, right? Once the session is created, web container has to set the session cookie back into the request in order to take it later. And we won't be able to set it because, the headers is committed. At that time, we throw the warning message that, hey, cookie cannot be set. Well, it didn't hurt this time in this request, but when the cookie is not set, the next request comes in, will not have the session information. So, that might break. And if you are expecting the session is already being established from previous request, then it's not there. Let's move on to the second one, which is illegal state exception cannot forward response already committed. So this error message is also very similar. In this case, the response is committed. And then later you try to forward it. And it's not allowed as per the specification. And we are going to see in next slide with more examples. So I'll leave it at this level. The third one is illegal state exception output string or writer has already been obtained. This is also an error. Application can have, one or two writers, but they can only use one at a time. Classic example of this is your JSP page. So when in the JSP page, web container will already give you the writer. Means it's a part of specification. You always have the writer. You don't have to obtain it, right? But in the JSP file, if you try to call something that response.getWriter and then obtain a writer and then try to use that writer, or even in this case, while you are trying to obtain it, you get the illegal state exception because you already have the writer. We are not allowed to give you the another writer within your JSP. So these are the three different flavors. I quickly touched on. Let's try to get into a little bit more detail. Let's go to the slide number 16, please. Okay, very quickly, this is a forward example. Now, this is a two-line GSP, right, just to demonstrate how things work. So first, three lines, actually. The first line is just a system out to, you know, display into the trace file or in the system out files that I'm here in this GSP file. Then the second line where I'm writing something back to the browser, this is my response back to the browser. That's the line that I'm displaying back on the browser. But right after that line, I am flushing the response, meaning I am forcing this response bytes to go back to the browser at the same time. Now, in this example, I'm forcefully forcing or flushing the response. But if you have a, if I keep writing a lot of lines here, and if the size of this output makes bigger than 35K, which is our default buffer size, then 2K?
32K.
All right. Thanks for correcting. So if the response size is more than 32K, then we are automatically going to flush it. In that case, you don't have to even call flush, and flush will happen automatically. So if we wanted to rewrite this, lots of lines here, don't flush it, and then try to forward it. If the response is what you have wrote back is more than 32K, you won't be able to forward it because we auto-flush the response. Okay? So now, let's keep this code in mind. If I try to execute it, I get this illegal state exception. Cannot forward. Response already committed. Right? And if you see into the stack itself, you can see that I am in the illegal test.java underscore, which is the compiled or translated version of the GSP. But exactly when I'm trying to forward it, that's this exception comes in. Now, let's go to the slide number 17 and check if we create a web container trace, how it will look here. So exception happens somewhere in the down, right? And if we go up, you know, we will see there is a response.flush buffer happening, and because the response.flush buffer happening, we will see the immediate commit entry and commit return. That's the, between these two lines, we are committing the response. Once the commit is done, there are certain things you cannot do. One of that thing is the forward. So let's check on some of the method calls. Let's move on to slide number 18. All right, so these are the method calls, which are, you know, very related to this kind of situation. Call to the following method after the committing response will cause this illegal state exception, right? So we touched on the forward, set buffer size. You cannot set the buffer size once you flush it. Reset, send error. Send error is kind of a forward. Send redirect is also, you know, one of the form of forward. Request dispatcher.forward is same as JSP forward that we just did. Get writer cannot be done. Add cookie cannot be done. Header cannot be done. In general, any API call that modifies the response headers, that method calls cannot be executed after the commit happens. So, simple takeaway from this all the example is when you see illegal state exception, think about commit. Something is committing my response and I'm trying to do something after the commit which is not legal. And just trying to find out in your application flow where I'm committing and should I be committing at that moment or I should take that portion away and do it later after doing the meaningful work. Let's move on to the slide number 19. Slide number 19, please. Thank you. Now, let's touch on the another aspect of 500. Many times we get the PMR, 500 is coming to back to the browsers. When we see the logs, or even into the web container tracing, there is no exception. So what is happening there, right? So the mostly the exception is in those cases the parameter is being set by application itself. Now, what information can we provide to customers so that they quickly fix it or quickly are able to, you know, identify the issue? The way we try to, give the pointers is, if we go into the sequence, webcontainer.handleRequest, this is a keyword you can use if you ever wanted to, play with the web container tracing. That line tells the starting point of your request with the URL. So in this case, patient record wsweb/servlet/rpc router, that's the request URL we are trying to handle. Now, after a few lines, I just mentioned that what is the web group is going to be handling this particular request. In this case, this trace line tells me that web application patient record WSE are going to handle this. Then, this is a very important part. When I see the service entry, enter the service method of servlet, at that time, as a web container, I'm started executing the code within this particular servlet. So now I'm entering into this RPC router servlet code. Before I exit from that servlet code, I see this line, status set to 500, okay? And then, which is on the response object, as you can see. And then later, I see that I'm returning back from that particular servlet. So I have a proof, or I have some kind of information that I can convey that within this servlet, you are using response.setStatusCode to 500 for some reason, so something to check in that particular servlet on why 500 is being sent. Okay? So that's how, if the 500 is being set by application, that's how it can be narrowed down where it is being set. Now, let's move on to the slide number 20. Okay, unexpected errors from web container. When you see the, some unexpected kind of error messages, like in this case, null pointer exception. It's not it's a common thing, but when the null pointer exception comes from the web container code, it is something strange, right? Web container code shouldn't be setting a null pointer exception for many reasons, especially in this case, when you look at the exception stack, all we are trying to do is to set the attribute into the request. Setting an attribute or getting an attribute, for example, if the attribute is not there, then it just returns null value. Don't supposed to throw the null pointer exception, right? So only reason this can happen is if the application is caching the request object, right? So the way to find it is going on the same thread. I can see which request object I'm operating on and with the ID, and then check at the beginning of the request what request object being assigned for this particular request. These two IDs are different. That tells me that, hey, something wrong. Means I switch IDs. In this case, example, my application is nothing but our own stack product, WPS, has done something wrong where they are caching the request object and developers of WPS able to find it. Let's move on to the slide number 21. Okay, a quick symptoms analysis. This is the common steps that you can take for any 500 error message debugging techniques. Is 500 return code is set by web container is plugin? First question, always ask yourself if you have a plugin in place, because if the plugin is setting 500, then you are in the wrong side of investigation. You should be taking plugin logs and try to find out why the plugin is setting 500. Many good reasons is maybe server is not up and running, it's not available, and plugin cannot, send the request or forward the request. So that's a different ballgame when you find that. If it is web container, then first thing you do is try to find the line where the status code is set. From there, you know the thread ID. In this case, it's 84, followed by a bunch of zeros. Use some good tool of extracting that particular thread from the entire trace file, because in the production environment, a lot of things are going on, right? You are just really concentrating on this particular 500, right? So grab that thread, extract it, and go back to the same line again and start going up. Generally, you should see some error or exception. If not, then you should able to see the service entries and exit, as we just previously mentioned, some key lines, and able to find out from where the 500 is being set. Now, there is another point who mentioned before, and we add it up, is one another way of knowing if the application code is set to 500 is the presence of FFDC. We always emit FFDC if there is a problem by the web container. So you can use that information as well. Let's go to the slide number 21, and I might have to rush a little bit to give enough time to focus. Incorrect information on the browser, the third one, right? It's about the internationalization issue. It can, mostly the garbled characters being seen, and maybe some rendering issue, session crossover, JSF view rendering issue. We are not going to touch on that. Let's check on the first internationalized issue very quickly on slide number 23. All right, so in the internationalization case, when you have issues with the encoding and stuff, right, most important knowledge center document that I found is this particular link. It's not easy to understand in one shot, so maybe read one or two more times. A lot of information is covered in that particular document. But in general, you need to know all of these six different properties. First is care set, which is nothing but the option of content type header. Second is set character encoding method call, which is the API call for response and request object. Two properties, auto request encoding, request encoding, and auto response encoding. Full explanation is on this link. Accept level header, default client encoding system property, and client encoding overreaches in JVM argument. So, as you know, understand this all these different properties. Now, let's go to the slide number 24 and see where all these properties comes into the effect. So now this is a flow diagram where which property takes the precedency, right? In your code, if you are using the set character encoding, response.set and character encoding, for example, that's period, that's the final. We are taking it, and that will be the use. If you don't use that, then we'll fall back to the get set option of the content type header. And use the information from that header. If it's still not there, then we are going to see if the client encoding overreach custom property is set. If it is set, we are going to use the value from it. If that property is also not there, then we are going to look into the auto request encoding and auto response encoding, if it is set or not. If it is set, underneath, what is happening is really we are using the accept language header of the request. And accept level header, I explained it in more detail in slide number 23, so you can read it on your own, but it gives you the bunch of language that the browser can understand, right? And with the preference, like what is my first preference, what is my second preference, and things like that. If that header is present, these properties will underneath going to read that and map it to one of the properties file that we ship with the product, and just use that mapping to find the correct encoding for that request. Try to use it. But if this header is also not there, then we are going to fall back to the system property called default client encoding. If it is there, we are going to use it. But if also it's not there, then at the end, ISO 8859 is the default pickup. So we're going to use this by any, you know, means. So the issues that we get, maybe the response need to use the UTF-8, but we use 8859 because from all these checks, we couldn't find anything appropriate, and we just use the default one. So hopefully this flowchart would come in handy when, you know, debugging the internationalization issue. So let's go to the slide number 25. Redirect issue, and I'm going to be quick on this one. We are going to look at some basics of redirect. We are going to look at redirects when there is a plugin in front of and when there is a non-plugin, like a load balancer, and some VAS-initiated redirect. So let's move on to the slide number 26. So basics of redirect is it's nothing but response.set send redirect, right? And in the method, that's the method call, API call that you do in your application. When you do that, you can send a relative URL or absolute URL. If you send pass the absolute URL, web container is good, means web container doesn't have to do anything. Because the absolute URL is there, we are going to use it as a location header and go from there. Now, before I talk about that, the general knowledge of redirect is when you call request or redirect, send redirect, the URL that you are passing, we are just setting that URL as a location header in your response of file. Response will be always 0 bytes. That is, we are not sending anything. And that 302 response code goes back to the browser, which also has a location header. So when the browser sees the 302, it reads the location header automatically, use that new URL and send that new URL request. So that's a redirect, right? And in the browser side, you see some clicking and, the reloading when these things happen. Okay, back to this discussion. If you pass absolute URL, web container has to do nothing. We are good. But if you pass the relative URL, and web container has some work to do. It has to convert that relative URL to the absolute URL, right? Now, there are two ways you can pass. If you pass with slash or without leading slash. If it's with slash, actually without slash, then we are going to use the path from where you are. Means if you are at in this particular application, at this particular location under directory structure, if you just say login.jsp in this example, we are going to assume that login.jsp is going to be in the same directory, so we're going to build the URL like that. If you use the slash login, then that means that this login.jsp is really at the root of the year file, var file. So we are going to use web container going to use build the location URL based on that information. Now, these are some properties. I think Tan did cover in part one, but it's very important properties. When you have something in front, then we have to use that plugins host and port or load balancer host and port in the location URL. And these are the properties used during those times. So, at your time, click, go to this Info Center or Knowledge Center page and read more about it. Let's go to the slide number 27. Application initiated redirect. We talked about this. So skipping this page and go to the slide number 28. All right. Two instances when the WebSphere is only involved in redirecting. One is when the SSL is enabled, and in the web.xml, under the security constraint, when you have transport guaranteed to be confidential, that means that this URL or this particular resource need to be only accessed on HTTPS. So if the browser sends HTTP request, web container will simply do the redirect adding HTTPS in front. So that goes back to the browser, and browser, it will force browser to open an HTTPS connection instead of HTTP. Second one is the security, right? When the resource is secure and you are not authenticated, then, you know, security component will redirect to the login page. At the same time, it will use the cookie name WASREC URL cookie, and, you know, that cookie just preserves your first URL that you are trying to go. So after the successful login, this particular cookie value will be used to go back to the, you know, the original URL. But these are the two cases where web container would be doing a redirect. Let's go to the slide number 29. There are some other HTTP errors we'll quickly cover. Let's go to the slide number 30. Let's talk about 503 service not available. Generally, this happens when something went wrong or maybe admin has started stopping an application, right? Stopping is in progress, but at the same time, we are still getting the request. It's not stopping yet, right? Plugins still haven't had that information that application is stopped. So we keep getting a request, but when we start getting those requests after the stop is initiated, then during our check, we see that, okay, the web app is started to be destroyed. And at that time, we are setting a 503 service not available and sends back to the browser. Let's move on to the slide number 31. Now, let me turn it over to the Foo to talk more about the threat analysis scenario.
Yes. I'm going to try to go over this quickly. So this is the presentation to show you the real trace collection on the application server, the base. But this trace should look the same whether you use base, MD, or express, or embed server. So the scenario here is the simple request coming in, and this is an overview of how the request is going through. We're going to go through the filter and that's going to do something, and they're going to include some file that not even exists. The tray going to show you how the server is going to handle that request by using the send error process, and how they're going to looking for the error page error type, and then if they file that, and how they're going to handle that those error types. So the first thing you need to do, you need to turn on the web container trace. If you have a problem, a lot of times, most of the service team is going to ask you to turn on the web container trace to begin with. Notice if the web container is the first two in the string, the HTTP channel and generic BNF, it belongs to the channel. However, we use a lot of these information during the when the request first coming in, and then after the request get out of coming out of the web container, there's a lot of information these HTTP channel and generic BNF can show us. For example, when the first one, when the request first coming in, they will show us what type of the method, that is a guest post, and then all the information like what is the request UI, if this is post data, how big is the data coming in. The little section at the bottom show you if you have the ISS or the plugin coming in, you may see some of the private header. Oh, I'm sorry, you please go to page 33. Sorry. Page 33, please. Need to remind me. Sorry, page 33, that's the one I'm talking about, the web container trace. So you need to turn on those trays, the HTTP channel and generic BNF, it belongs to channel. The WF private header is, if you have the plugin or ISS in front of walls, then they will send those header along with the request to the application server. Go to page 34, please. So at the beginning of the request, before we're doing anything, we need to set a bunch of default values. For example, in this case, we're setting the write type, either async or the synchronous, and how big is the response buffer that we can hold the data for the application. By default, it's a 32768. You can change this number to any integer that you want, but ideally it should be the multiply of 8192. That's the optimized number for the TCP IP packet. You can verify what type of sync or write type that we're using, sync or async, and how big it is in the data trace. You can see it there in the red line. The next thing is the web container is going to give each request one request object and one response object ID. That's the one that you see in red with the add some integer number. During the entire service of one request, there's only one request and one response object. If you cross use this number or cache it somewhere and then reuse it in the next request, you may run into the NPE, as she had mentioned earlier. Next page 35, please. At the beginning, the application server, the web container, will set the default status to 200. This status code can be set at any time, but has to be before the response is commit. If you set that after the response is commit, you're going to get the illegal state exception. The next thing the web container trying to do is going to try to locate the virtual host and the port. They're going to help web container see where is the what part of the application or what virtual host should handle this request. The next thing is going to be the contact route, and then that's going to point into the application that install in this application. If they cannot find the information, you're going to get the 404, the virtual host not found, as she had shown earlier. Next page 36, please. Right, so the default response encoding, that's the one that she had shown earlier. That's how we determine what type of encoding that we should using for this particular request. We're going to go through a bunch of process like that, encoding, response encoding, and then char set. Those chart that she showed earlier are going to apply here. That's how we're using to determine if what kind of encoding we use. The default is going to be ISO 8859 if nothing has been defined. Next page, please. Page 37. So before we serving the request, we have to build up the filter change. First, we need to see if we look into the web XML, we see if any filter defined. If it's yes, then we're going to try to build a filter change for this particular request. The chain is going to be using the order of the filter defined in the web XML. After the filter chain is built for that particular URL or URI, we're caching that filter chain in order to improve performance. So if the same request coming in next time, we're going to look into the cache first. If there's a filter chain actually matching for that particular URI, we're going to pull it out from the cache. So without that, avoid the cache being built over again. So that's mainly for the performance purpose. Next page, please, 38. This one basically just show you what I just saying. We're looking to the web XML. We determine how many UI filter have been defined there and how many service filter have been defined there. After all that is done, we start to execute the first filter in the change. You can see that by verify the executing filter, the red one. Page 39, please. So the filter are going to be executed in that order, and the last element in that change is the target. That's the resource that you're asking for, whether it's a servlet, JSP, or a static file. So we're trying to serving it. The keyword here you're looking for is the service keyword. That signal that we are now entering the resource service, meaning most of the action in this block is going to be controlled by the application. There's some interaction with the web container, like, for example, if the application needs to get some of the attributes, they're going to call the request or get attribute, or they need to set some of the response, then they call us. We provide an API for the application to call down and set those things. But we can react to whatever the application call. We do not initiate any of the action within this block. The next thing is when the application ready to write out some data, they can either get the get writer or get output stream. The get output stream is used mainly to write the binary data. That is for servlet. The get writer is used to write the text data. It's used mainly by the JSP. Now, in your application, you can use either one of these, but not both. If you call one and then you call the other, we will throw an illegal stack exception and it may break the flow because we cannot obtain the data to write out for you. So I think this is something that she already told earlier, talked about earlier. When you have the data, and then the next thing is the application may commit the response by explicitly called flush, or if the buffer in the web container is full, we have to flush the data out to make room for the next data. And if that happens, we will flush automatically and commit the response. Next page, please. Page 40. So this is showing the HTTP channel trace right here. This is where we send out the first response. This is mostly a header. So the status code is 200, and then we have some more additional data is going out. At this point, the data is commit. Then the response is go back to the wine, get out to the go back to the client. Page 41, please. So after that, for this particular request, the application is gonna do some process and then write a little data back to the client, and then it continue to include a non-exist target, like call nothing here. The web container go through the repeat process, like they're gonna do the filter, and then they're trying to locate that request target, the nothing here. But unfortunately, we cannot find it because the file does not exist, so we're gonna throw the file not file exception. And you go to the next page, page 42. Now you notice here, this is set by the application server. We set the status to 404. However, because the response already commit, the status 200 already come back to the client, we cannot send out it anymore. So I got the warning, illegal stack exception, and I ignore this 404. Then the web container trying to finish wrapping up before they can handle the error for this application. You can see the exit of the service for that particular include. Next page, please, 43. This slide showing you the process of how web container is going to handle the error for the application. So they first are going to build some kind of error report to log some information in here. Now you notice FFDC is in here. Like if you see the status 404 and then you see the FFDC is around that area, then most of the time that's a server trigger that self status. This is something that Ashia told earlier. The next thing in that process is we're going to try into looking for any error page have been defined in the web XML. The error page can be defined using the error code or error type. The server is going to use the error code first and then error type. You can switch the order. You can using the error type first and then error code. There's a custom property for you to switch that order. After we locate the error page to handling this 404 status, we're going to trigger a new process to go to the error page and handle it, handling that error page. Page 44, please. Now, the process to handling this error page is similar like any other process. Like you have to go through the filter. If the filter has not been there before, we have to build up the new filter change for this particular error page, and then we're going to trigger that filter in that order. And then the last target in that filter change is that error page service. When I complete the service, we get out, and then there's some internal process after that, but it's that the application should not worry about that. From the application point of view, this is the end of your process. The rest is the application server trying to clean up before they accept the request. So this is the summary of what we've been talking. Under our next page, please, 45. Yeah, the summary of what been she and have been talked earlier, and some of the trade that I have been to show you some of the common error and how the web container handle the request and then dispatching handle error page and then access the request. Next page, please. You can see some additional resource or link document info in the info center. I'm sorry. Those links can provide you. If you need more information, you can contact us, and we can provide more information for these information. Now I'd like to turn the control back to Kathy.
Thank you, Ashish and Fu, for a great presentation. At this time, I'd like to move on to the question and answer session. Well, there are some questions that are in the group chat. I'm going to show slide 7 because that was when the question came in to me. On slide 7, should it say does not have permission in the very last line? The if request resource is present as expected, location and WAS process has enough permission to execute those resources, should it say does not have enough resources?
Thanks for the question. It's a very good question. So I think you are going one layer above where, what you are trying to say here is the WebSphere process, a user of WebSphere process has enough permissions and the resource is also there, but then not enough resources to execute, meaning all the things that I can think of is the running out of descriptor, like the file descriptor. That might be ULimit, for instance, right? If the ULimit has been exceeded, then in that case, you see the different error message, not the 404. I would expect to see, out of memory kind of error message where you don't have the enough resources or all your file descriptor has been used up. So is that answer your question, or did I miss anything?
I don't have anything in there just yet, so I'm going to go on to the second question, and if Muhammad does respond, we'll get back to him. The next question in the web conference comes from Ramesh. If we have a cluster of two application servers, and on top of that, we have HTTP server and session replication is enabled on the two application server clusters, Now let's assume admin has initiated restart of server 1. Will any of the end users receive a 500 internal server error? If yes, how many times? Is there any way for 100% uptime of application while restarting application server?
Okay, thank you. I understand the question as a clustered environment with the HTTP server and the plugin in front of it, the session is configured to be replicated. This question is more towards a plugin functionality than the application server or web container. Now, if in your example, when one of the server of your two cluster member environment or any cluster members, one is going down, the plugin, once it knows about it, that and identify the server is not responded for that particular request that it sent, it will fall back to the another working server. So let's say plugin has sent a request to the server 1. It is in the process of stopping. So it won't respond, or it will respond 503 if that the timing is correct. But in most cases, you know, the response won't be received, or the plugin will receive the some kind of notification is server is going to be down. So at that time, plugin immediately fails forward to the other cluster member and send that request to that server 2, and server 2 will handle that request and sends the response back. Does it cover your answer? Please confirm.
We'll see if we'll give a second for Ramesh to see if that answers his question.
Yeah, so I can see the Mohammed question now. So I don't think it is a typo. I really mean the permission, not the resources. The resources to me is like memory, a CPU, and all that. If there is no enough resources, you will see different things, not the 404. You will see, we won't have even resources to process a 404 response, right? You will see the out-of-memory situations, hang situations, and all kinds. Right now, what I meant is the permissions.
Okay, so that's the answer to the slide 7 is that is not a typo, correct?
Yes.
Okay. There is one other question here from David. What kind of minimal trace can I turn on if I just need to find out what IP address is sending this HTTP request?
All right. Very good question. It is an HTTP channel, right?
No, it's a TCP.
TCP channel, right. So,
and then you have a plugin in front of it.
So the Fu and Tan here are giving the feedback that TCP channel is equal to all is the trace string that will tell you exactly from where the request is coming from with the IP addresses. Now, there is a better way that I can think of to do this is there is an access log. So at the application server side, not just at the plugin side, now there is a full access log support at the web application server side. And you can turn on that access log. And in the access log, now there is a flexibility which kind of attributes you choose. One of the attributes is the client IP address. So you can just choose that, and it will display your IP address right there in one line.
Yeah, and that is called an NCSA access log that you can enable that from the console. So it's different trace than the web container trace.
Yes, and it is the name of that log once you enable. It's access.log.
It's a HTTP underscore access.log.
All right, thank you. David, did that answer your question?
While we're waiting for David to see if that answers his question, I'm going to go back to Christina. Has anything new come in on the phone line?
We do have two questions on the phone line. The first is from Ramesh. Your line is now open.
So, Ashish, you mentioned that we have a number of attributes which can set to get the required information in the asset.log. Can you tell us how these attributes can be set? It is a custom property or some changes which we can do somewhere?
Yes, Ramesh, so there is an HTTP channel custom property the custom property name is access log format, one word. And it is well documented in our info center. So if you just search with access log format, you will see the custom property. And in the info center, and now we call it as a knowledge center, you will see the different options that you can turn on. Very similar to, if you are familiar with the HTTP server access log, we try to match up exactly the same kind of way. So you can minus percentage D, percentage I, and these are the different options that you can make your string on. And one of the another cool thing I will tell you about the access log is when you set that custom property and make your access log format what you want, also add your own line, meaning you can just put your text. For example, client IP address and in a text format, and then you put percentage I or whatever, right? Then destination IP address or put your name. URL, you can write that thing inside. So when the logs are created, it's more kind of human readable or more that you know how you want to be, look at. You can capture many good things in it. What was my response size? It will print out the bytes. Of the response. It will print out the time it took to, and it is most important if you are debugging the performance or trying to find out the bottleneck in your application, use that. It will tell you each and every request how much millisecond, actually it's in a nanosecond, how much nanoseconds each request takes. And you can, customize your access format with all those information. Is that helpful?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Speakers, I see that there is some follow-up stuff going on in the chat concerning David's question. Would you like to maybe recap what is going on there so that people on hearing this recording can actually benefit? Again, that the initial question was kind of minimum trace. Can I turn on if I just need to find out what IP address is sending this HTTP request?
I think the follow-up question from David is, David doesn't have the web server in front of the app server, so he asked if the NCSA access log is still working. So yes, because this log is specific for the app server, it's not on the web server. So on the web server, we have different access logs, but it looks very similar.
Right. So, don't confuse with the web server. You don't have to have it, right? Once you turn on the NCSA access log at the application server side, the time and things will be considered from the request when it hits the web container and it leaves the web container. So all the information will be captured for that particular request for those two instances, between these two instances. And then if you have the web server, you can turn on the access log there as well. And, for the performance cases, it was helpful to even narrow it down where the request is taking more time, right? If the plugin is saying that, 10 seconds is being consumed by application, and here we can see that only 5 seconds consume, and some we can able to narrow it down, like there are some delay in network between application server and plugin. So a lot of debugging or performance tuning can be done with these two information.
I think Mrs. Gabriel from the presentation side, as Ashish mentioned in one of his earlier slides, he had a showing where the web container was actually comprised of four different layers there, and how tightly it's coupled with what we call the channel framework layer. And that channel framework layer kind of acts as a mini IHS server, you can think of it, or an HTTP type server, and that's what this NCSA logging will collect. It will collect all the information coming through that, as a HTTP server would. Now, granted, it doesn't have all the nice bells and whistles that the HTTP server does have, but there is some basic functionality in there.
I don't see anything new that has come into the web conference. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. And thank you, Ashish, Fu, Gabrielle, and Tan for presenting today.